Twitter is the craziest fucking place in the world. I love it. I hate it. I visit it. I ignore it. My followers include Mark Mancini, aka Italian Bad Boy, Alyssa Johnson, Miami Herald investigative sleuth, Amethyst Hypno, an erotic hypnotist, Miles Wallace, a computer support therapist, on and on and on and on and on. And I always say I'm going to leave, and then at some point, I'm still blown away by the merging of people and ideas and thoughts and philosophies. So instead of bolting today, I'm just going to plead with my number one Yang listener, Elon Musk, to do us all a favor and please just fucking sell the damn thing before we all leave Twitter in the dust. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Tova Friedman, a survivor of the Auschwitz concentration camp and the author of a fascinating new memoir about her experiences titled The Daughter of Auschwitz, My Story of Resilience, Survival, and Hope. And a programming note, for this episode, my wife, the great Catherine Perlman, serves as my co-host. Because, hey, this is episode number 320. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right. Well, Tova, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. This is the first time my wife has co-hosted with me because, just so audience members see, you are the author of the book, The Daughter of Auschwitz. And my wife and I were at the Tucson Festival of Books, and I did not see her session, but she came up to me and she was raving about, I just saw this woman speak and she was amazing and she was fantastic. And it was you. It was not someone else. It was you. And I sort of wonder, you now have become very well known in speaking circuits because of your book, because of your grandson introducing you to TikTok, as someone who speaks about your experiences growing up in Poland, then Auschwitz, everything you went through. Do you ever get tired of telling these stories? Do you ever get exhausted telling these stories? Does it ever feel like, okay, I just want to watch TV now?
Without a question. Of course. Sometimes I say, oh my gosh. The worst is when I have to talk more than once a day. I'm going now to a place, they scheduled me when I tried to tell them that it's difficult, but that's how their schedule worked out, for more than once a day. Yes, I find it physically exhausting and a lot emotionally exhausting because I don't have any script. It's not something that I have prepared. The way I talk is the way a child talks, and that's visually because I was a child. So it's not an intellectual exercise to me. And it's not something I read about, and it's not something I heard about. So each time when I speak, I sort of relive it. There are times when I relive it more than other times, but it's always emotionally challenging.
I was thinking about how you must have so many visual memories, because like when you talked about that you didn't read or write, and you only had the memories from Auschwitz, nothing before. And so you have a very visual memory. And so when you think about what happened to you, it's all visual. And one of the things that struck me about hearing you speak is that you picked a journalist to write with so that you could somehow connect your memories to what really happened.
Well, that was an interesting thing. I thought of writing my memoirs, but, you know, life is so busy and I'm working and so forth. So I went to this a commemoration of 75th liberation of Auschwitz in Poland. And there were all these different journalists, and Malcolm was one of them. And he came from London, or I don't know, London, but England. And he told me that he is the overseas writer for PBS. He interviewed me, but a year later, he called me after I was home already. And he said, I'd like to write your biography. I said, it's very hard because he's not Jewish. I didn't feel any connection. But I said, you know what? Let's try. It's COVID. neither of us are doing much, can't go out. And amazingly enough, it worked. He sort of showed me more where I was, like when I talk about the big ghetto and little ghetto. He did some research, and I didn't know exactly where the little ghetto was, and he showed it to me. He did a lot of report type of work, which helped me a lot, because I have memories of a child. I have the emotional and the visual. He has the political and more global. So as a team, we were very good.
You had mentioned about how you had remembered a woman wearing a skirt in the concentration camp. And then people said, no, no, that couldn't be. Can you talk a little bit about how you figured out how that happened?
No, I just did very simple. I looked on the internet. I mean, everybody said there were no women SS, you know, German soldiers. They were all men. And I said, but how come I remember a woman? So years later, don't forget this. This is not something I thought about and forgot. Years later, and there were four or five women, and they were vicious. That's why the internet has a whole thing about the women that were part of the entourage in Auschwitz. I don't know which one she was, but they even have their names. I knew it.
You were five and a half when you and your mom were taken to Auschwitz. Your dad was taken to Dachau. You were born in 1938. How do you know what you can trust as a memory versus I was just a little kid and I have this image, but maybe it was built up over time? Like, how are you able to?
Okay. I don't know what you mean by built up over time, since nobody told me about it. And I didn't read, I read very few Holocaust books. I didn't borrow anybody else's memory, as far as I know, because with the memories come feelings. You know, it wasn't just my memory. I was there as a child is there. I even remember my dreams in Auschwitz. Nobody dreamt my dreams, my thoughts, not all of them. Just you know, certain spots that I remember. And another thing, you know, you don't have any diversions. It's not like, well, this is happening today, but I could also go and play. I could also read a book. There wasn't anything else. So these memories are very strong because it's all I had. Not all of them. I mean, I'm sure there are things that happened that I have no memory of.
When you carry these memories for all those decades and you have them and you have them and you have them, is there something cathartic about actually putting them in a book and doing something with them?
It's not the book, because what was very important to me is that I share it. You see, I don't have what is called survivor's guilt, but I always had an obligation since I'm very young that I can't have all these people have just died and disappeared. I mean, because I think I'm here by accident. Nothing, we didn't do anything special. We weren't, you know, we weren't rich. We weren't anything. We didn't bribe anybody. So I felt that I am here by luck, and another little girl standing next to me, had she been through what I did, she may have survived and I would have been dead. So that I feel an obligation to talk about it. The Catholicism came way before, because I've been speaking to schools for a long time, a lot, to young people. But the book was terrific, because I used to wonder, what's going to happen? You know, I'm 84, almost 85. And when I'm not here, I am the last of the generation. In fact, I'm one of the last people in my entire town in Poland. The town is done, gone. Some died naturally after the war. Out of 15,000 people, 200 survived. And they were adults in 1945. So how many are left? maybe four or five, maybe somewhere in the world. I don't know. I know one person is in California. She's 95. In other words, I feel this obligation. And now that the book is out and people all over from, what's wonderful, the book has been translated. You know, I only know one language that I could speak it. Right now it's in 19 languages or so. That means people who've never even met a Jew somewhere in Africa or in India will be reading it. And that makes me as if I'm telling all those perished people, you're not going to be forgotten. The world is going to remember you. That's what makes it so absolutely mind-boggling for me.
I feel like when I saw you on the schedule, that was one of the talks I was for sure going to go to, for the same reason is that I feel like we have an obligation to hear you because you are so rare, because even there aren't that many stories, and it's like a mitzvah to listen. And then when I'm done talking, listening to you, I tell my husband, I told his parents, I told so many people about your story and your book and your life. And so I think it's important for all of us to do that, you know, because there are all these people that, you know, have trouble remembering that the Holocaust happened and all the things that happened to you.
I hope what I do, I hope that I succeed, is through the individual story of one, which is one can relate to one person. They understand the enormity of the issues. Take me, multiply me by 1.5 million children. And that's the story. That's what we all went through, the same thing. It was a pattern. They had a system. I wasn't special. When I was tattooed, 50, 60 other children were tattooed that same day. Do you know what I mean? It just didn't make it. When I was on in a cattle car, thousands of kids were put in those cattle cars. But most of them were killed upon arrival. But I want them to know how it felt to be for a child inside a cattle car. So in a sense, I feel that it's my story, but it's not my story.
One of the things we do in journalism a lot is we actually do try to give people a sense of place and understand what it's like to play center field for the Yankees, or what it's like to play keyboard behind Michael Jackson, you know, that kind of thing. I do wonder if you could put into words, what is it like to be a little kid in a cattle car?
Well, first of all, I can describe it to you. I heard that it took 36 hours, but I didn't know about that before. I didn't know time. Later on, I think somebody told me that this, well, first of all, I was very small. I was with women. They were all women. Men and women were separated. It's the first time that I was separated from my father. And I was standing very close to my mom. We were all standing. In my cattle car, there was no room to sit. There was some that I heard you could sit, maybe, but you couldn't sit in this one. So I remember terrific heat and terrific hunger, but thirst. Nothing to drink for such a long time, and nothing to eat. And one of the worst things, which is interesting for me, was that I had to go to the bathroom, and I didn't know how to do it because you were standing next to somebody else, very, very close. We couldn't move. So I realized that everybody was making wherever they were standing. You could tell the smell. I remember I was so tired. So I put my head against a woman facing the other way. I put my head on the small of her back. And I just fell asleep like that. But my mother was next to me. There was the screaming, the crying, it was like, wow, is that the way it's supposed to be? Don't forget, I never knew of a regular life. I've never been to school. I never had toys. I certainly couldn't read or anything. So it was like, oh, That's why I heard people going to Auschwitz. I heard the name Auschwitz. I saw the cattle cars before I was in it. And I said, oh, that's what it is. It was like having heard about it, and now I see it.
One of the things that struck me when I heard you speak was that, you know, we're Jewish. We grew up in Hebrew school. We've heard a lot about the Holocaust. And yet, when I heard you speak, I learned something I didn't know. So you talked about how there was a Jewish woman who was the one tattooing you.
Right.
And how kind she was to you to try and help you learn your number.
Right.
So that was something I didn't know. I just assumed there were Germans and they were all working.
No. That is a completely wrong assumption. Everything dirty and mean and horrible was done by Jews. Not the shooting, of course, but the getting people into the gas chamber. It was forced labor. In other words, the Germans used us to kill us. Do you know what I'm saying? A German would not tattoo us. That's menial work. That's the job of another Jew. Who do you think shoved people into the ovens after they were gassed? The Sonderkommandos, Jews, mostly Jews. Who are the people who then took all the clothing from the dead and cleaned it or whatever so they could go back to Germany for use? Jews.
That's so important, I think, for us to hear, for other people to hear your particular story, because you remember something or you tell a specific aspect of your story that maybe somebody else hadn't told.
Who do you think was our caretaker or whatever you call them? A Jewish woman under duress.
Your number 827633 tattooed on your arm. And obviously through the years, if you wanted to, you could have had it removed, or you could have, you know, like.
Of course. A lot of people had it removed.
It seems like you view it as an important part of your story, and almost something, I don't know if need is the right word, but something that you almost, that's there for a reason.
We are a team. You know, when I was in America, I came to America, and as a refugee, you go to a doctor, they check you out and so forth. And one of the doctors said to me, I'll give you a gift. I will give you plastic surgery. I'll remove the tattoo. I was 12. He said, by the time you're a teenager, older, there won't even be a sign. And you won't remember any of this. And you know what I said to him? I say what I think. I said, you know, if the tattoo had been right here, I would not have erased it. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not ashamed of it. I sort of wanted to show it to people, but nobody wanted to look.
One of the things that I think happens when people go through trauma, you're also a social worker, so you understand, is that people can get to a place of despair, or they can go to a place where they're so grateful to be alive and have a sort of an optimistic air. And hearing you speak, you are probably the most optimistic person I've ever heard. What makes you such an optimistic person after everything you've gone through? How do you get this way?
I don't know. A lot of things, you know, my mother, for instance, did a great job in saving me. She was there at every moment. When the war ended and she realized that nobody was left alive with her family, she was the sole survivor. She went into a serious depression, and really serious depression, and she died very young. She died at 45. She really wanted to die. My father, with all of this, began to learn English, started to work, and he was very impatient with my mother. He said, look, three of us survived. A whole family, how many people survived, you know? It didn't help. She said, but I lost everybody. So it also has to do with personality. But with me, I think, I always had this feeling that I want to undo it. I don't know how to explain it in other words. Like, I couldn't understand what Judaism was. I knew being a Jew, you had to die. but I didn't know what Jewish was because we didn't celebrate anything. Maybe later on in a DP camp, but not as a family. My mother was just no longer interested. She came from a very religious family. But she said, if God killed every single one of the of her family, so what's the point of religion? What's the point, you know? So because Hitler also wanted to get rid of our religion, I began to study it. And I'm still doing it, by the way. I had a class this morning. I studied, I tried to figure out what it is. How do we keep our nation going? I love, I'm a Zionist. Lived in Israel for 10 years. Two of my kids were born there. It was like a feeling of, I will not let a crazy, mentally ill man define me, that I am a worm. What shocked me is not, I could almost accept Hitler's craziness. What I can't accept or understand is the German people, all those intellectuals and the writers and the professors and the musicians, the artists, they went along. That is almost more painful to me than Hitler, because you could always find one crazy person, you know? But to have an entire nation following a crazy person, I don't understand that.
My mom's mother, her mom died in Auschwitz, and she always carried, my grandmother carried that her whole life. She could not talk about her mother. She would cry. She would never go back to Germany. She had opportunities to go back to Germany.
I never went back to Germany.
Right. And my mom, a couple of years ago, when we had the rise of Trump in this country, said it would have given my grandma chills. Like, she would not have been able, just the way people were behaving just had too many echoes of something she had known growing up. And I am interested how you felt as an American now.
I don't feel this at all. I'm worried. I'm not worried about our government. I have a terrible feeling towards governments in general. Oh. I think all governments are corrupt. I don't care whether they are Republicans or Democrats, whether they're in Israel or power really corrupts. It's part of a characteristic of power, and money maybe also, but power certainly corrupts. But what upsets me, of course, is the rise of anti-Semitism in the country in general. Do you know, I spoke at a college that had no Jews, and they had an anti-Semitic parade. No Jews. So how is that? They don't even know any Jews. It's this kind of a, as if people need somebody to hate, and we've always been scapegoats, so it's easy. Do you know, in therapy, we have something like free-floating anxiety. You're anxious. You don't know what for. What are you anxious about? Things are good. You're doing this, you're doing that. There's free-floating anxiety, and you catch on to something, and that's it. That's your scapegoat for your anxiety. The same thing is this hatred of Jews. It's almost like a mantra. I don't know what it is. People don't even know who we are. And yet they feel they have to, great, great thing. Well, why should we hate them? They were hated years ago. The Christian church hated them. Hitler hated them. Oh, no, let's join. It's very, very scary.
It's also strange because we're treated as a monolith. Like, I'm Jewish, you're Jewish, therefore we're the same. I'm Jewish, some guy in Alaska is Jewish, therefore we're the same. It's just the Jews are put in this bubble in the same way Blacks are put in a bubble. And, you know, it's a strange thing because we're not all the same. You know, it's a million different people.
That's philosophical. We are the same. Theoretically, we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be a people. We're supposed to be cohesive. Jews are supposed to help each other. That's what our Bible says anyhow, if, you know. So I'm okay with being the same. What I'm not okay is that somebody else who's never met any of us. Do you know, somebody told me that they went recently to Midwest and somebody asked for the horns.
I had that growing up. Yeah.
It's ignorant, stupid. mean. That's what scares me.
So when you decided to become a social worker, I'm a social worker. I'm very interested in how a person goes from this sort of young tragedy, I mean, just horror on top of horror on top of horror, to being able to then help other people and take, you know, you have to take yourself out of the equation when you're, you know, in therapy and helping other people. How did you come to a place where, you know, you've processed and now you're helping other people with whatever it is that they're going through? Like, how are you not, listen, you're not in the Holocaust. You're okay. Things are okay. Like, how do you manage that?
Look, you do not compare traumas. You don't compare pain. It's like saying, my toe hurts me terribly. What's the big deal that your toe hurts? My arm hurts. I mean, pain is pain. No, I don't think like that. Also, you have to understand something else. When I came to America, I have a gift of curiosity. I read English within 1 year, and I spoke fluently. And I graduated with honors in 1 year, eighth grade. Went to high school, went to college, traveled, met my husband, had a family. I had a life. I don't have a card that says Holocaust survivor. I've met somebody who does, by the way. Yeah, I did. I was in Poland once, and somebody came over to me and said, here, I'm a Holocaust survivor. I said, oh, that's interesting. Is that the only identification you have? That's it? I have other sides. When I was in Poland at the commemoration of 75th anniversary of Auschwitz liberation, it was like a celebration. People came with children and grandchildren. They talked about the books they've written. They talked about the families they have built. They talk about the charities. It was a limitation. It was not a, you know, if you said to somebody quietly, where were you? They will tell you. But that's not what was the purpose of it. It was more of a celebration of survival and life.
In chapter 9, I just want to read something you wrote real quick. You wrote, over the years, I've often wondered why they didn't shoot me on the spot. They probably just assumed that within a few hours, we would all be turned into ashes and ask themselves, why waste a bullet? Right. After walking for maybe 15 minutes, we approached a train and my courage faltered. It wasn't the sight of the cattle car stretching endlessly behind the locomotive that shook me. And I knew the power of guns. They had my respect, but they didn't intimidate me. I was unnerved by the dogs, those German shepherds. Beneath the fur, there's nothing but muscle. They were lean because they were permanently hungry. The dogs are straining on their leashes, baring teeth, panting in the heat and salivating. They wanted nothing more than to be let loose. They smelled our fear and wanted to feast on it.
I remember the German shepherds better than I remember the soldiers. It was just impossibly scary, even to this day.
You work on the book with an author and he puts it together with you. And then obviously you go through it and you go through it again and you go through it again and you want to make sure the book is tight and you want to make sure it's good.
And I make sure it's my voice.
I write books about athletes. There's no pain involved in writing about athletes. You know, writing a book about Bo Jackson is not painful to me. It's not scarring to me and it doesn't even impact me personally. It seems one thing to tell your stories. It seems a different thing to tell it in a book form where you're going over it and over it and over it again and you have a certain way you want to deliver it.
I want to tell you, I had a lot of sleepless nights.
What was that like?
You know, after we wrote together. This is like, it's a combination of both of us. I would write a paragraph with a description and then I would send it to him on the computer, you know, on Google. And he would see it the next day because when I was up, he was sleeping. You know, the hours are different, right? And I had terrible nights because these things came back. I still do, by the way. It's been a year. Things are much more in the surface now. I remember myself much, much better. I see myself as a little girl. And I, you know, I have eight grandchildren. I just can't imagine that this would happen to my grand. I can't imagine at this stage of my life even. They're human beings who love their families, love their wives, love their children. They put the children to bed, then they'll take somebody else's child, they'll hurl it against the wall, and the child's bones and everything is shattered in front of the mother, and the child is, of course, dead. And then they go home and they tuck their children in. And that kind of a dichotomy, the kind of a separation of my job to kill, but I really love because I know how to love because I have my, you know, in Auschwitz, they used to have parties. The men were gone such a long time that the women and children came to visit and they had their own quarters. And they had cooks and they had music and they had the best food that you could bring from anywhere, all over the Europe. They had great food and they adored their children. They missed their children terribly. And then they would leave, walk out of the room of their little compound, go to the barrack of the children and shoot a few. I don't know. That's why I'm scared to go to Germany.
You've not been back?
No, I can't go. I haven't been back.
All right. So in the almost 8 decades of your life since this happened, have you in any way, shape, or form been able to understand how those people were able to do that? I'm sure you've thought about this a lot.
Nobody understands. I just was listening to Elie Wiesel. He was interviewed and just by accident, YouTube. I'm not on social media. I don't know. But somehow, oh, here he is. And he was saying the same thing. He said, I don't understand. None of us get it. None of us get it.
Because what's different, it's like when I see a rapist, I listen to a podcast about somebody who's done terrible things. I'm curious about their childhood. I'm curious about how they were treated. I'm curious about what brought them to this point.
That doesn't interest me. You know what interests me? I don't care about his childhood. It's not an excuse. What I care is how he can go now and kiss his own child.
Exactly. To me, that's what
bothers me. Yeah. You know, we have holidays, Thanksgiving especially, when the families get together because it's a non-denominational, everybody celebrates Thanksgiving. And we have these turkeys and all that. And I'm thinking of the homeless. I buy a few turkeys and I go to the food bank. I say, you know, I can afford it. What's the big deal? I know people who can't buy a turkey. So I go to the food bank and I buy a few non-kosher because they don't need kosher anyhow. I do. But I buy 2 or 3. I just learned what kind of turkeys, you know, butterball or something like that. And I bring it to the food bank. I said, I don't think that I can eat with my children and family when somebody else can. It's a minor thing to do. It's nothing. It's $20, $30. How can you kill one child, beautiful little child, and then go and kiss your own? That is what I don't understand.
Yeah.
Childhood, we all had childhoods. Some grow this way, some, nobody had great, in the world, most people, I read about, they had a conference for people who had perfect childhood. Nobody attended.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, and I'm looking at the credit card bill. Did you use my Visa to buy a 55-inch television?
I did.
Why would you do that without asking?
I thought it would be a nice surprise. Now we can hang out on the couch and watch the Philadelphia Stars and Michigan Panthers play in the first ever USFL championship game.
Casey, that was 40 years ago.
Oh, I just realized all this talk about RoyalRetros.com and throwback jerseys and hats and t-shirts isn't an in-the-now thing. So Chuck Fusina isn't starting at QB tonight?
You just wanted a TV, didn't you? You said you have 8 grandchildren. Do you feel like, I mean, there is a problem in this country where people definitely don't have the same awareness for the Holocaust, don't have the same, in a sense, interest in the Holocaust. Oh, it happened a long time ago. Oh, it couldn't happen now. You are a living embodiment in front of your grandchildren. Do you feel like they have a full appreciation for what you
do. Oh, do they? Poor kids. Yes. Well, one of my grandson put me on TikTok, right? Yep. He's the one who interviewed me. I am going tomorrow to Iowa, and one of my grandkids is coming with me for 5 days. He's going to attend all my talks. I promised him that sometimes he can sleep through them. It's okay. And I'll take him out to a very delicious dinner if we find a kosher place that he can eat.
In Iowa.
Iowa, I'm sure there must be some. I don't. Well, we have hosts and they'll take care of us. So, yes, my grandkids are very much aware of it and they will be my continuity. I must tell you, they will be.
You had mentioned that at one point you had to give a talk, but you had no voice and your grandson gave your talk for you.
Yeah, I'm very worried about that. Also, having somebody, I'm trying to be very, you know, I'm learning to be very unemotional so that I could breathe. Yes, I was in Indiana and something was wrong with the air in the plane because I got on a plane, I was fine. Now I wear a mask, make sure that I don't. I got off the plane, I couldn't talk. I don't know what happened. So my grandson took over. He did all the talking for me.
Such a joyful gift that you've given him because now he's giving it back to you. He's going to show you that like your words are going to mean something. You're not going to be here forever. And at some point he'll carry it.
Well, it's a different grandchild. You see what happens? Each one is a different grandchild coming with me. One does this. One. When I come back from Iowa, I have one day at home and I'm on my way to LA. But a different grandchild is coming, not the one from Iowa. An LA grandchild is coming. I just try to I try to have them as part of my life as much as they're willing.
You blew up on TikTok. You became a thing on TikTok. You're a big TikTok thing. I'm guessing you're not regularly checking TikTok. But it seems
I never watch TikTok.
So how has that impacted the messaging? Because it feels like it's really kind of sent you out there to a certain degree.
Yeah, well, what happened was my grandson said, when I go there for Friday night dinners to my daughter, and he said to me, you know, I spoke to the kids at school today. He's 17. Nobody knew about the Holocaust, and they don't even know what Auschwitz is. He said, you know what? He loves TikTok. He's been on it for years. He spends all his time social media, those kids, games, everything, right? So he says, maybe why don't you tell me, I'll make a little video of you for only 2 minutes, he said, because that's the attention span, 2 minutes only. I said, okay, nobody's gonna call. I said, what do you mean people call? He said, yes, people watch and they react. I said, really? I never heard of TikTok. So he did it. It was surprised thousands of people with questions. So he continued, you know, nothing succeeds like success. So he was very pleased and he's been doing it since. It's about a year now.
You're a star. You're a social media star and you don't even use social media.
I guess.
Let me ask you a final question. Something I think about a lot with the Holocaust and with my own family and with you. You went through hell. You went through the absolute worst of the worst of the worst. And I wonder, sitting here now, almost at 85, how does that affect your view of your own mortality? How does that affect how you view death and your own life?
Well, my own mortality, I was worried who's going to continue, but now I'm not anymore. I say to my grandson the other day, you know, you better be nice to me, to one of my grandkids. When I'm gone, you'll miss me. And he said to me, Grandma, the whole world will miss you. I said, oh, that was a beautiful response. I said, I certainly didn't expect that. I said, really? He said, yes. I said, wow, that's a gift. Seriously.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
The book is wonderful. And as two Jews sitting in a closet here in California, we both really want to thank you for doing this.
Now you're going to have people listening to this. So you're part of the process of helping people not to forget. Thank you very much.
I want to thank today's guest, Tova Friedman, for joining me on Two Riders Singing Yang. You can become one of Tova's 514,600 TikTok followers by following her at Tova Friedman and by The Daughter of Auschwitz, My Story of Resilience, Survive on Hope, wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the memorable MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.